All right, everyone, let's get the show started. Welcome to Office Hours. It's April 22nd, 2020. My name is Eric Osterman, and I'll be leading the conversation. I'm the CEO and founder of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator. That means we help companies own their infrastructure by building it with them and then showing you the ropes. If that sounds interesting, go to cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. For those of you new to the call, the format is very informal. My goal is to get your questions answered, so feel free to unmute yourself at any time if you want to jump in and participate. If you're tuning in from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. We host these calls every week. We'll automatically post a video recording of the session to the Office Hours channel, as well as follow up with an email so you can share it with your team. With that said, let's get kicked off. We have a couple announcements just to make, bringing up some of these again from last week. We have our community resource page up, which is at cloudposse.com/community. That's where you'll see all the resources that we make available to our community and give kind of a checklist to walk through. We also launched our merchandise store. This is just to, if you want to share the love and, you know, represent SweetOps and Cloud Posse, feel free to go there and pick up some swag. Other announcements outside of Cloud Posse. One thing that I'm really digging are the sections in Slack for being able to separate your channels out. Now, unfortunately, we can't use this on SweetOps because it's not a paid team. But if you're not yet using this feature on Slack, I highly recommend it. Basically, it lets you, why doesn't it let me? Because I'm in full screen here. Basically, with sections under Slack, you can break down all your hundreds of channels that you have in your company team based on how you want to organize it. And then you only see the notifications that you care about. Plus, one thing I dig is this. You can have it only show unread conversations. So it works a lot like inbox zero, and you only have to worry about looking at new messages that you need to see. So that's how I'm using it, and I dig it. The other announcement, somebody shared this actually in the SweetOps Slack this morning. HashiCorp has announced they are now doing certifications for a number of their core products. From the look of it, it was Vault and Terraform. I'm not sure if Consul was on there. Yeah, Terraform and Vault are the first two that they're offering certifications on. So that's interesting. Curious, anybody here, would you be interested in taking one of those?
Depends on the price point, right? I mean, if it's like another $200 thing or something like CKA, yeah. I might do it.
Were you the one asking the other day about taking the CKA exams, or was that somebody else?
That was someone else.
Oh, okay. Somebody just was talking about, like, is it worth it? Anybody here have their CKA certification? Do you recommend it for others? What did you learn from the process?
What is CKA?
Oh, Certified Kubernetes Administrator.
Correct.
Yeah, Eric, I have done my CKA certification. CKA and CKAD, both I have completed.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get the participants up here so I see who's talking. Oh, Hari, cool. So you took it. What do you think the main value was to you in going through it?
Yeah, first of all, we will get more confidence on working with Kubernetes once we are done with the certification. Those are more challenging scenarios where you need to do hands-on definitely before you attempt the examination. So with that, you will be able to get more confidence and
you benefited personally from doing it.
Personally, with respect to what?
No, like, for example, I think if I were to do it, I wouldn't do it because I think it's going to increase my job prospects or it's going to make me more competitive. I would do it.
Of course. I have
to get missing out on that I don't yet know about in Kubernetes more than I want to do it for some other reason.
Yeah, right. With respect to the job, I'm getting benefited in my environment.
Okay. Cool. So that was those were the announcements there. There's been there are a couple talking points that I just one is left from last week. I don't think we got to it. The other was just something that came up because GitHub was down again this week. I'm sure everyone here knows about that. And Microsoft will always be the brunt of all those jokes. But there are just a couple tips that I think if you're not practicing this yet today, you might benefit on. One is Slack, you know, there's an app for it. It's free. You can subscribe to RSS feeds. We create a channel for this, Cloud Posse, where we subscribe to all the RSS feed of the status pages that we like. And then we get notifications when all those services are impacted. So this is kind of like the lowest hanging fruit to get some of those alerts. So this is what I'll show you what that looks like. So like we depend on bill.com, we depend on GitHub status. So here we can kind of just see the stream of services we depend on, you know, failing. The other thing you can do is if you use Datadog, I believe Datadog supports the ability to subscribe to RSS feeds. Pretty rad. And when the services are impacted, you can see if those correlate to other outages of services that you depend on. Does anybody else have any other tips on how to use RSS to your advantage?
You can do the same, by the way, for Alert Manager, the Jira Atlassian tool for alerts. So I'm using it, and then I'm attaching basically my internal alerts to it. And what I did this week, because, well, it pissed me off that GitHub was down for the, I don't know how many times in this year already, I build, like, when my pipelines fail, and I have, like, 10 pipeline failures in a certain period, I just put an alert up as well, because before alerts were not triggering, but if you developers cannot push code and merge requests, it's kind of something you want to know about. Because
yeah, I mean that's a good point. You only know there's a problem if something's running during that time. So wait, what are you doing then to catch it? I missed the first part. I think you said I just missed.
I just use like the webhooks like of pipeline failures, and then I basically say, hey, if X pipelines failed in an hour, I just have like a small service that posts a message to Slack and as well as to my alert manager, which is, Opsgenie. I meant Opsgenie the whole time. You can subscribe with Opsgenie to stay as
payment. Oh, I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry.
But maybe there's also something for Prometheus.
Yeah.
Does anybody have use something like that with Prometheus?
There might be a status page exporter or something.
Yeah. So it's kind of like having the equivalent of deployment notifications going to Prometheus. It would be having RSS feed items going to as notification, timeline notification.
Yeah.
All right. So Zach, you're not doing anything with that? Andrew, Roth?
Not now, no.
Okay. Does that seem appealing, do you think? Or do you have any other opinion on it?
I haven't had the need for it yet, so.
Yeah.
This is Sheldon. I've been trying this week a little bit of Elastic Cloud, the hosted one, based on the last call, and found it really interesting.
Start looking into the APM stuff that...
Sort of. The APM is a little bit longer reach. What I was trying to do is a minimum viable implementation, something that I could do like in an hour, something quick, right? So I just threw a quick PowerShell script together for Heartbeat. It looks like the configuration is YAML based, so it was pretty straightforward. And then I ran a command through SSM to publish that out to like 100 or 200 instances. And so the Heartbeats work pretty well. They have this uptime section in their cloud. The Heartbeat does allow any website, like any URLs, to be monitored. So I'm very new to this stack and this tool chain. I'm more Grafana and FluxDB in the past, and so I'm curious if anybody uses this for external service monitoring as well.
Yeah, makes sense. Here,
you're the one using it, right? Yeah. So what I did is just like with Heartbeat check, like AZ to AZ. So I was checking like, hey, can EU Central A one reach US Central one? So this is what I did with Heartbeat. So I can see, hey, can my AZ still talk to each other? And at what time can they do it? And then orchestrated failovers over this particular tool.
How is this priced, by the way? You know,
APM is basically all.
Or no, the like the Heartbeat service. The Heartbeat is just part of the package.
It's an open source tool. You can just run it on your server. You configure it, but you can also pay for it hosted, and then it costs like I think $10 or something.
Yeah. So I just was blown away. I actually have a follow up call with Elastic to talk about it. But as a initial implementation for it, it seems like a no brainer that any company could just sign up, because the starting price for a full like stack that they deploy for you for Kibana, Elk, everything, the whole thing, it was like $100 a month to get started. Yeah. And there's no, unlike a lot of the services where they say, okay, add APM and now it's like another $100 per agent or 50 or whatever.
Yeah.
This is actually, you just pay for the infrastructure. Huh. And so if you need to size up your infrastructure to handle more tracing, you know, upgrade that. But you don't have to pay extra, like a lot extra, just to add additional service. You just need to install the agent.
Yeah, that is pretty rare these days. Actual resource-based pricing as opposed to arbitrary agents or...
Also, the pricing, or other things. Like per year, is super, super cheap compared to the monthly pricing. So I have like a 12-month contract with them where I paid upfront all of it. And it's like, instead of... For my cluster size, it would have been 8,000 something a month. I pay a year, and now I pay like 4,500. Like, it's not me; it's the company I work for. But yeah.
Yeah. So even if I just did it for the uptime, I figured it was compared to a lot of tooling, that was absolutely cheap compared to many tools. Just to say, let's monitor an entire, you know, AWS deployment and install the agent, and all I have to do is pay for that. You know, the infrastructure that's deployed. That's pretty good deal.
So, well, yeah, let's get into everyone's questions. Sheldon, in particular, I know I prodded you to join. You're always posting a lot of interesting questions throughout SweetOps. Sorry, we don't always get to answer them for you. Most recently, you asked one. Do you want to summarize that question? See if we have a conversation around that.
Are you referring to the Terraform Cloud piece?
Let's see which one.
Yes,
I think I responded to a few today. I'm not sure. I'll let you pick a question since you have.
Okay. Well, so it's I can, you guys can pick which one you want to talk about. There was two of them. I think the first one was the open source side of it. I've worked historically at commercial companies that have no experience or practice of doing open source, and retroactively adding that for a company can be really, at least from my observation, can be really concerning. So what I'm looking at right now is I'm trying to draw up a proposal to support more open source material for the DevOps type of work. Historically, you know, I totally get intellectual rights. I get that, you know, you have an NDA and you want to protect your work. The challenge is that because there's this gray area, there's a lot of work that DevOps does that's basically already built on the back of open source stuff that we may contribute back to, let's say Terraform modules, things like that. And when they're abstracted properly, that have no private information, obviously, for a company. So what I'm trying to do is propose a clear policy on that, rather than it being this gray thing where, you know, somebody could blog or whatever in fragments, but to say publish something that's done well, and not necessarily with the company's name underneath the company, because there's not a lot of people doing this, but just to have support for blogging on that material, and to, you know that it's not an area in gray, but it's an area that's actually approved and has a proper channel. And then the second piece is the Terraform Cloud. That piece, I've had various discussions over the last month in various places. So, you know, it's definitely a topic.
Since that was a mouthful on the first one, and sure. That was actually the one I was thinking of, the original okay. one brought up there on open source. Let's first talk about that
Sounds
while
great.
It's fresh in everyone's memory here. I posted a link to it in Office Hours, the original question, if you want to read over that, what Sheldon just shared. So to recap, or maybe let me just simplify part of that was like, if your company is doing open source and you're open sourcing things that weren't born originally as open source, what has worked for you? What's been your process? Like from getting the legal teams involved, getting the process involved, getting the sign off, ensuring that you don't have leakage. Like one of the main things, like when you're open sourcing existing software, is you often need to create a fresh, clean repository with no commit history, because you can't go through every single commit and make sure that nothing sensitive was leaked, or possibly you infringed on copyrights at some point there. You don't want to syndicate that. So you should have a clean commit history. So what are the tools that enable a company to do that?
The license? Oh, sorry. Yeah, just you want to have a CI/CD. Assuming that you actually have, oh God, the mailman. Assuming that you have like actual buy-in from the executives, which is really key. If you don't have that, that cost me my last job. Ideally automate as much as you can, like have a CI/CD process that does the license checking, like Artifactory, for example, will do that for you. It'll tell you which license, like for your dependencies, because people that's often harder to deal with is like the legal fee. People will freak out about modules that you might import from Maven or something, like, you know, just external dependencies.
There's a free one for open source that we've been
yes.
using, this license scanning.
Yes, there are.
By Fossa. I'll link that one. That's a good one. I think our focus will be largely a lot of the tools that you can leverage to build confidence that you are not exposing yourself to additional risk. I think Fossa is one of those things that helps ensure that you maintain license compliance. Other considerations is what license to pick for your open source software. Honestly, I think if you take a license other than MIT or Apache 2, I think it's a major roadblock for adoption, because a lot of companies will shy away from GPL. AGPL is just like hard stop. Companies just don't touch that stuff at all because of contamination.
Yeah, BSC 3 is also, I think, relative, like, easy.
I've had these conversations multiple times. This is bringing back nightmares. Don't make your own license, please.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not.
It makes those tools like Fossa useless.
Yeah.
Pick a license that's already out there.
Also, like, if you have, like, at my old company, it was like, if it's not standard license, we will not use it. We will not touch it. We will not get legal involved. No matter how awesome the tool is that we want to integrate, we will just not touch the library. That's just how it was handled.
Yeah. Then.
So you guys are describing some great stuff in terms of licensing. I'm not even at that point. I'm assuming I would use MIT, let's just say, okay? But yeah, this is something where, again, this is small stuff, but let's say I create the other day I had to create a URL, signed URL for S3, and I wanted to, you know, experiment as I've been trying to learn some Go to create a utility that would do that and also handle multi-part uploads or something like that, okay? Just as an example. So something like that would be a little ad hoc project on the side, maybe a few files, that's it. But it's not something that the company necessarily is going to publish. It's something that I would need to get right off, sign off so that I could publish it under my name. This is not like, I don't foresee the company I am at.
GitHub, not like under your organization. Yeah.
Like, I'm not even going to propose it from the company because I don't believe the culture here is designed right now. And there's not a lot of people. I've fought for this for like a couple of years, and I'm finally getting some buy-in on that. But it needs to be where there's basically very little involvement other than just them being happy that there's no risk. So this is very much small utility, Terraform module, that type of utility-oriented functions. And definitely not something that would be CI/CD through like the company. It would be more of set up and then published as kind of an opportunity for me as an engineer to share that work.
I think so. So long as this depends on your, this is going to be on a case by case basis and your contract with your company, basically on who owns the copyright to inventions and all of that jazz. Sometimes you can get away with, if you're developing this on your own time and then you release that as MIT on your own GitHub, then there's nothing wrong. I mean, then it's just another project that you can incorporate in your work at the office, just like you do any other tools.
But I'm not referring to that. I'm definitely aware of that side of it. But because at least I'd wager that the majority of us do not necessarily work a full day and then just play around with Terraform for hours and hours and hours after that. It's kind of part of your job, right? So in this case, I'm referring to, yes, I already have an NDA, and technically any type of blogging or snippets, if you want to get real, real technical, like Joel Spolosky dealt with in one of his articles, anything that I write when I'm a salary employee technically is the copyright, even on my own time, technically in the way that an organization works. Now I'm got the opportunity to potentially help shift that culture a little bit and present an approach on how I can submit something in, they can feel safe, and I can contribute something that I've built at work, but that is more utility based, you know, and then share that. That's the challenge I have. I'm very familiar with the copyright issues and all that type of stuff. That's why I'm looking for tips or templates and stuff that people might have had on that process for a company.
Yeah.
I gotta make them feel safe.
Zalando has a nice contributor guideline. I can email that or I can share the link because it's basically helps people participate in their projects, and you have to sign. You know, they basically want you to provide a GPG key, and so you might want to just look at that from like the outside, you know, in the opposite direction, and that might help.
I mean, this is why bigger projects always have the contributor license agreements, like Kubernetes and Cloud Natives and all that stuff. But it does introduce a barrier to entry for other people. I don't know. My thing would, I wouldn't overcomplicate this decision right away. And I would walk in the gray area initially just to see how it goes before you create too much procedure around it. Unless what you're building is something like, self-driving autonomous trucks, you're getting acquired by Uber, I would for these very small one-off experimental projects, not be too concerned about it. If you're building your, if you want to build Prometheus, rebuild Prometheus from the ground up as a big project and do it on your company's dime, but on your GitHub, then I think you're going to run into problems. But if it's a small utility thing here or there,
You're describing, that just for clarity, that's exactly right. And you know, I blog regularly as I get a chance and do snippets here and there. And I know that technically it's in a gray, but it's not an issue because I'm very, very, very careful about everything that I do. And it's more concept related. It's not, you know, something larger. The challenge to that is I'd much rather publish a demo repo of how to do a Packer, say I built a Packer pipeline that includes automated tests through Pester and a matrix build. That's like really useful because I haven't found anything that was built to do that. So I want to share that as a build template so somebody could leverage it. But technically, that's where this type of thing is not quite the same as just a snippet. It's more of a couple scripts and, you know, supporting material. That becomes a little bit of a gray area that having a policy in place can help protect, you know, a company as well as protect me.
Understood. I think we've covered most of the bases.
Okay.
But that was an interesting conversation. So circle back, Sheldon, in a few weeks, if you figure something that worked for your organization is always interesting.
I feel that what we're observing here is probably just the difference in cultures between companies. And it's, I guess, not often that a company that's very close source then says, all right, give me a policy for open source. Most of the material I've found and the discussions all refer to company open sourcing like applications and stuff like that.
Yeah, you have to change people's minds at the top. The main avenue that I will usually go down is when it comes to like the DevOps world and we're trying to recruit top talent, you know, where does that top talent live? They live in the open source community. They live on GitHub. They live on Stack Overflow. They live on Slack. You know, if we don't have any kind of presence in any of those areas, you know, why would top talent ever want to come work for us?
Yep.
And that tends to start kind of waking people up and go, oh, maybe I should have kind of some kind of open source presence.
That's excellent. That's a good point.
CTO, and the CEO are in alignment. And then lead chief legal counsel is told that, look, we understand, because their first response always is going to be, they have no incentive to let this fly. It opens them up from their perspective to unlimited risk and liability with very low upside from a legal perspective.
Yes.
This is where CTO have to say, well, there is an upside and it's worth the risks to do this.
Excellent. That's great points. I appreciate y'all.
So let's see. We had a Zach, I think you posted some talking point in the Office Hours channel. Anybody else as well have some things they'd like to get answered today?
I just did a quick post in the, this is Ronak, in the Zoom group chat. It was around Atlantis. And a basic question that I had was, is there a way that it can understand the changes from one build, one commit to the other, and then say, run the plan for all those places versus having to run it manually?
So what Atlantis does is it looks at it doesn't even look at Git. It just looks at the files changed via the GitHub API or your VCS API. And then it computes the directories from that, maps that to the projects configured in the Atlantis manifest, and runs a strategic plan on that if you have auto plan enabled. So do you have auto plan enabled in the manifest for Atlantis?
No, I don't have that enabled. It is enabled, but it's running at the root level. Versus it's not determining the changes that happen. So maybe there's some configuration change that I need to make.
So I think maybe the fix here is to then, if it's running at the root, then that means that what you really wanna have is basically what you wanna do is look at your repository as a monorepo of microservices or smaller projects. I'm assuming your Terraform code, you've broken it into projects, like you might have a VPC directory and you might have a
EKS.
So then VPC becomes a project in Atlantis, and then EKS becomes a project in Atlantis. You don't put it at the root level, you put it at the level of each one of those projects.
Okay, I'll take a look. Is there a link or something that maybe I should...
Yeah, see here if we have some. This is going to be a little bit out of date. And to be honest, Cloud Posse, we're doing a little bit less with Atlantis these days. So my
Are you moving away from Atlantis and using what? Like, are you guys
doing? A few other things. We've been using CodeFresh more. We're doing a project right now, re-implementing like an Atlantis flow in Jenkins. In a POC grade, we're doing more stuff with Terraform Cloud. What I didn't like with Atlantis in the end was having to manage all the infrastructure for Atlantis itself. And I just wish I had a turnkey appliance for it that we didn't have to manage.
So I'll reach out to you personally just to try to understand. I work with Ryan, you know, Ryan.
Okay. Okay.
At Calm. So I'll reach out to you separately just to try to understand how best to have developer enablement so that we don't have to run things, because we are using Atlantis for the development team to actually apply changes, and we just have to
review
on the plans. What are the alternatives to that that you guys have seen? So that would be a good, like, I was going deep into the thing, but maybe there is a better workflow that you guys can propose.
There's just a lot of options now, because Atlantis was born a couple years ago when this whole concept was foreign to most companies. Mm-hmm. And it blew my mind when I saw it, as I think it blew a lot of other people's mind about how awesome it is. But now kind of the ability to do that has become easier with the tools out there. But I don't want to say, like, Atlantis makes it pretty darn easy. Implementing the Atlantis logic outside of Atlantis proved to be a lot more work than I could have anticipated. So, and then that's technical debt that we got to manage. So I don't know. This is why I say, like, somebody somewhere else that came up in the past day, like, what were we doing 2 years ago versus what are we doing now? 2 years ago, we had really bad GitOps, if any. Now we have pretty good, but I don't think we've solved it, like, to the point where, like, I can say nailed it. No, I mean, we're still coming up with that. And if you see my screen, I'm still sharing it here,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So this is just what I meant. Like, so then each project that you have has a separate definition. So the account DNS, the ACM, et cetera. And then we have auto plan when these files in that directory change.
That's too much work. Like, defining all of that.
But this can be general. First of all,
The the projects might keep changing. Like, you might add more and more. It has to be auto generated, I suppose, to actually.
There's a little bit of that, and then Alex shared something pretty rad because it's just YAML in the end. Oh, this is actually great for anybody else using Atlantis. I mean, we're familiar. I mean, as engineers, I'm pretty sure we're familiar with using YAML and YAML anchors, but I just totally neglected to think about using them with Atlantis. So Alex Siegman in our SweetOps community, he shared his refactoring of the Atlantis file using anchors. So it becomes pretty dry. So adding a project just looks like this. And then if we take this and then we also combine that together with what you're saying there about generation, this YAML file can very easily just be generated based on the projects that you have.
Okay, I'll take a look. And also maybe we can chat about some alternatives.
The other thing, I've been teasing this a little bit here and there. I've been wanting to do a demo on it. I still need to get approval from the customer. But this stuff with Variant that we're doing, it's so, so beautiful for creating a CLI tool that applies your entire project, either strategically per project or per folder, or like cold start, like from zero to full-blown infrastructure in one command, defined as your own CLI tool. And the tool for that is this Variant.
I'd love to see a demo of that sometime. I was looking over Variant and I was trying to figure it out, but seeing it in practical use would be kind of cool.
I think seeing it in practical use, like if it doesn't immediately jump out as awesome, I think then
seeing, something's wrong with me is what you're saying.
Yeah, then seeing it in practice, you're going to dig it, because I think we're aligned on that.
Is that actually creating like infrastructure, using Terraform?
No, so this is the thing. So you know, HCL is just a language. And it's a declarative language for describing, the state.
I see, okay.
So what if you describe what your client would look like? Like in pseudocode, you can just describe it in Variant, what it should look like. What parameters do we want to have? What options do we want to have? What jobs do we want to be able to run? And then you specify the run commands that you want to have for that. But the driver for it is just Variant. And then this compiles down to a single binary that you can distribute cross-platform to run your entire DevOps toolchain at your company. And you don't have to have one variant. You could have lots of variants. You could have, this is the tool that developers use for their local workflows. This is the tool we use for production or for AWS infrastructure. This is our tool that we use for GCP infrastructure. However you slice and dice it is up to you. But what I like about it is it takes an opinionated approach for defining your client tool in a way where you don't have to be a Python wizard. You don't have to be a Go developer. You don't have to be writing the stuff in Java. And your tool chain spans languages. So this is kind of like your agnostic way to define one CLI to stitch them all together.
Okay. So yeah, it would be interesting to look at it, especially around versioning and how you promote them and, you know, the same
outside dependencies and things like
that. Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing. So Moshe is building his own little HashiCorp of tools. One of those other tools that he's building is called Mod. And Mod is all about a generic way of managing versions of software with automatically, so it has a generic schema here that you define for your versions. And then the Mod tool itself supports opening PRs for you against your repo and bumping these when the versions change. So you can have a PR-driven workflow for promoting versions of your dependencies.
Define declaratively too, which is cool.
Exactly, define declaratively too. Zach, this is going to make more sense to you than most here. Zach, you're a big user of our packages repository. If I were starting Cloud Posse packages again today, I would probably do it in Mod.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of making it a project of mine of redoing that whole thing in Go. So maybe Mod will end up being the thing instead.
So yeah, what I like about doing it in Mod then is that we have the power of Momosha behind us.
Yeah, no joke.
He's a
formidable power at that. So.
Yeah, so I'll share Mod here in the channel as well. All right, any other questions?
Eric, you mentioned ColdFresh earlier. I'm kind of curious in terms of, your experience with ColdFresh and what you thought about it or what you think about it.
Yeah, so we've been using ColdFresh for a really long time. Now it's been really long time, right? 3 years, whatever, since this stuff
came out. It's like an eternity in our industry.
Yeah, it's an eternity in this.
True.
So this is going to be my candid kind of response on that. So when we started using ColdFresh, this was well before Circle CI came out with their V2 and their totally redesigned UI for that and description of and YAML declaration of how pipelines should work. I don't feel like the other alternative tools like Jenkins X wasn't around and Zach, I need your help for the CI/CD buzzword.
Circle CI and all those around.
No, yeah, but the self-hosted options. You know, GitHub Actions was
GitLab.
Out. We didn't have Argo.
There's Harness.
GoCD. We didn't have all
Travis. Travis.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and Travis was kind of like the gold standard at that point. I'm being a little bit overly generous there, but yeah, Travis was like pretty familiar. So Travis was quite revolutionary when they came out with very simple YAML, declarative YAML pipelines managed by them. But the world keeps spinning, and we've come a long, long, long way since then. So ColdFresh is somewhere in the middle of that list. They were really early to adopt this whole concept of each step is a container. Bring your own container, declarative pipelines in YAML, very easy parallelization of steps, native Kubernetes support, integration with most of the things you'd want to do. So integration with Docker registries, integration with Kubernetes, integration with Helm registries, integration with all these things, which you could do in Circle. You can do it in Travis. It's just you need to express it in a page of YAML to do the same thing that is one line of code in Codefresh. So it's very terse in that side. But there are things that Codefresh, I think, can do. Well, okay, one other thing. If you use the Codefresh API, what's kind of cool is the definition of your pipelines look like a Kubernetes CRD. So I think that's a nice definition or a nice standard set for defining pipelines. Okay, so that's all the pros kind of. The cons. The API leaves a lot to be desired. Their CLI tool, while powerful, very error prone and buggy. The exit codes inconsistently exit 0 when there was an error, and you would have expected an exit code of 1. There are features of the API that you would expect to be able to do easily that you have to jump through hoops to do. But I don't even want to be dealing with that API. I want to just like GitHub Actions or GitLab runners. That experience is so pleasant, where you just add a pipeline to your repository and it magically works. I don't need to go click around and set up triggers. I don't need to go do all this manual clickups. I just want it to automatically discover my pipelines. So this is what's proven very difficult with Codefresh, is that there ends up being a lot of manual configurations to get our pipelines up and running. And this is, it's like 1% problem, first world problems, right? It's like, we've come so far and now I'm complaining that I got to do all this manual configuration on my pipelines. And yeah, well, so that's that. GitHub Actions is, I think where we're leaning right now is like a fusion between Codefresh and GitHub Actions, where we leverage the things that GitHub Actions do really well, like dispatching events, creating your own types of events that you can trigger, and then fusing that with Codefresh for defining some of our more advanced pipelines.
Got it. Okay. No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, Eric, I wanted to ask that, the automatic discovery and all that, I really like this. I do like the fact that things seem to be moving more towards Docker, so that we don't have to worry about all those dependencies. Yep. I wanted to mention that GitHub Actions are auto-discovered. As you mentioned, Azure DevOps pipelines, which I've been experimenting with, also are if you're using their, their repos. So you check it in, it immediately gets CI/CD. But what I want to know is, it seems like a potential conflict to me about, say, tools like Variant and everything. I really like the concept. But if you're already handling all your dependencies in Docker and so on, where does stuff like the mod and Variant and those type of tools, where do they tie in?
Yeah.
When you don't have to worry anymore about those dependencies if you already have your Docker, if you're doing it in Docker.
So yeah, let me answer that
okay.
In two ways. So first I'd like to take a brief step back historically. And like we talk about the different disciplines in software engineering, and like you have your DBAs and you have your software developers and you have your sysadmins, and now you have your DevOps, which are somewhere in between. And we approach these, and you have your SecOps team. And we all approach these with kind of the lens of our specialty. So like the DBA is going to say everything should be stored procedures and defined relationally in the database, and that's from their realm, the beautiful architecture. And then we know where the problems ran into that. And then the software developer is going to be wanting to use their ORM to describe all of these same relationships. And then the SecOps team is complaining that there's no strategy for how you're doing your secrets, and that people in operations want to streamline automations, but which mean hard coding secrets in a bunch of places, and we have all these problems. All right, so where this comes up based on what you're saying is like, so we have these CI/CD pipelines and they're running these workflows. Where does a tool like Variant come in if we have the CI/CD pipeline to be doing that? And that's kind of like going from a release engineering first approach that if you have it there, we shouldn't have it duplicated somewhere else. And I don't know if I have to explain that perfectly, but where I'm getting to is that if we focus on just doing it in CI/CD land, being able to develop and iterate on that locally is very slow and tedious. And our pipelines get very complex. Where what's kind of nice is if we can keep our pipelines very simple and declarative, and then have a tool that we can iterate on and run locally just as well as a tool that we can run in our CI/CD pipelines, just as tool as well as we can run through chat ops in Slack, I think that is really nice to be able to achieve. Also, if the tool exists outside of our platform, we're not strictly beholden to Azure DevOps right now because that's the nicest thing. Or we're not beholden to Atlantis because that's the best tool for right now. If we have our tool set independent of our CI/CD platform and our CI/CD platform is just calling our tools, maybe we're in a better place. That's the theory.
I agree on that because, you know, the CI/CD toolset will always change, right? Like you mentioned earlier, you know, everybody was saying earlier, well, there's Cofresh, there's Jenkins X, you know, there's Harness and all those. I mean, there's a new one coming out almost every single year. And yep. You know, every little thing has their own shiny little tool that, you know, you kind of get your eyes on it.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. I mean, look, the same thing can happen here. I'm saying variant. Next year is going to be some other tool. I guess that can happen. This is a rapidly evolving ecosystem. The tools are changing. The other implications of this, like Atlantis blew my mind originally on the GitOps workflow that it introduced. But then what I realized is what I don't like about Atlantis is we have our normal CI/CD process for promoting software across stages, and those pipelines exist outside of Atlantis. So Atlantis now becomes this totally separate, out-of-band process of deployment, and I would like much rather have one pipeline that ties it all together. So what's interesting about this is if we can define this stuff in a tool like Variant that I can just run locally now, and I can put that tool in a container, now I can run that container anywhere containers are run, and that's most CI/CD pipeline solutions these days.
That's very helpful. Thanks.
All right, I got a question.
Sure thing.
If I give an instance role to a Kubernetes node, and I set up a profile, and I'm running a, and then inside a pod, I'm running a profile. I set up a profile for AWS CLI that says, you know, credential source EC2 instance metadata. I get that metadata, and I get access to AWS CLI. That's bad.
That's why you use service accounts.
How do I disable that?
Kubernetes service accounts. So and you don't assign any instance roles to those instances. And the other thing you can do, which we've done for EKS, we haven't done this yet. I don't believe we have to, but I could be mistaken there. But let me show you what I'm talking about. So for COPS, what we did is then we add an IP tables rule as a systemd unit that firewalls that.
Okay. Is there a way to, so my problem is I'm working in an environment right now that does not allow AWS credentials, like, you know, public key, private key. The way we do any kind of AWS CLI is through an instance role. So, you know, I have to have a bastion or whatever that I SSH into, and I get my creds through EC2 instance metadata. Am I able to conditionally allow the ability to retrieve that instance metadata to some pods, but not others?
So the instance metadata, with service accounts, I don't know the answer. I know more the answer with KIM, which I'm more familiar with. Anybody else know the answer? So with KIAM, basically the metadata is public and exposed to the pods. Or you can restrict or whitelist paths of the metadata in KIAM. And then the credentials are generated by the IAM proxy, of course, based on the annotations of your pod. Now, for service accounts, it works relatively similar, but I don't know about the extent that the instance metadata API for non-sensitive data, what is exposed for that, I don't know.
Okay.
But you are using the service accounts with your EKS clusters, Andrew?
It's not EKS.
Oh, what is it?
Oh, this one is RKE Rancher.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So but you're using RKE without EKS then.
Right. Okay. No hooks into AWS at all. You know, we don't have the, you know, it when you create a load balancer, it does not automatically create an ELB or anything. But we're giving the nodes a instance role so that, you know, if you're, let's say you, you know, you're running Kubernetes on this node, but let's say you just SSH into the node, the actual host.
Yeah.
And you run AWS CLI and you can run CLI commands using the instance metadata. The pods running on that host also have that ability. And I want to figure out a way to conditionally allow that.
Yeah. So this is why, have you seen the architecture for KIAM and how KIAM works? So no. With KIAM, you have agents and server, they call the other piece. You have one or two servers just for HA and then agents on each machine. The server runs only on a restricted node pool with instance profiles. And the server is what's responsible for generating temporary STS credentials and giving them to the agents running on each of those nodes. So this means that on any one of those EC2 instances, you don't have...
You would not do the instance role for, or the instance profile for all the nodes. You would only do the instance profile on, like, you know, one subset of nodes.
Exactly.
And then you would, what's the name for it? Tolerations.
So that nothing is scheduled on there, and then
then
KIAM server tolerates being on that taint. So the server runs there, but then all other pods run on the other nodes and speak to the KIAM agent. So then,
then
the other thing you can do for extra security is adding this IP tables rule, which means that. There's a small window of opportunity before the agents are started on the node that you can access the metadata API. So that's why what we did is we added this one-shot unit that starts up before Docker to firewall the instance metadata API from Kubernetes.
On all other nodes.
Yeah. So first of all, we don't give them any permissions, but then as an extra safety precaution, we also firewall it.
Okay. That's, and KIAM is the new one, right? Not the one that likes to DDoS AWS.
Kubed IAM is the one that, there's three options. So Kubed IAM is the first one that came out, which if you run Kubed IAM, it's going to DOS attack AWS and get your account rate limited if you're running larger clusters, because every single node is running Kubed IAM talking to the AWS APIs. KIAM fixes that by running it only on a trusted node and it caches it for all the agents. And then service accounts is the evolution of that where it's running it for...
But that's EKS specific.
That's EKS specific, yeah.
Yeah, that won't work for me. Sounds like KIAM
To be honest, I haven't looked up running AWS service accounts on COPS. I haven't looked up to see if it's possible. We haven't tried it.
Well, you should be using roles, right?